In one fascinating moment, a member of his party, Shmuel Katz, argued against giving up the Sinai, to which Begin replied, "But Sinai is not part of the land of Israel, even according to the Bible." To this, according to Shilon, Katz replied, "What does this have to do with the Bible? I mean, you can use it to prove almost any borders you want." Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 212, Ike, Egypt, and Israel. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It was one of the most eloquent statements of American support for Israel, George W. Bush's address to the Knesset on the Jewish state's 60th anniversary. Bush said, quote, "The alliance between our governments is unbreakable, yet the source of our friendship runs deeper than any treaty. It is grounded in the shared spirit of our people, the bonds of the book, the ties of the soul." When William Bradford stepped off the Mayflower in 1620, he quoted the words of Jeremiah, "Come, let us declare in Zion the word of God. The founders of my country saw a new promised land and bestowed upon their towns names like Bethlehem and New Canaan. And in time, many Americans became passionate advocates for a Jewish state," end quote. The bond between America and Israel, in other words, is one of shared values. At times, however, administrations were tempted to assume that only through a distancing from Israel, or even a showing of hostility to it, could the U.S. be seen as a quote-unquote honest broker, embracing the mirage that only in turning away from Israel could peace be negotiated and achieved in the Middle East. This is what is learned from Michael Doran's excellent book, Ike's Gamble, where he describes the story of the Eisenhower administration's support for Nasser in Egypt. Quote, "It is a tale of Frankenstein's monster, with the United States as the mad scientist and the new regime in Egypt as his uncontrollable creation. From among the young officers around General Naguib, Colonel Gamal Abdel Nasser would soon emerge publicly as the true leader of the free officers and as a charismatic figure in the wider Arab world. In keeping with the honest broker approach, Eisenhower identified him as a strategic partner, as the only leader capable of ushering in a new era of cooperation between all of the Arabs and the West," end quote. As Doran goes on to describe, in the period before the Suez battle, the Eisenhower administration supported Nasser's Egypt with technology, and the CIA even established a front organization in the U.S. designed to create distance between the United States and Israel. All this reflected, as Doran puts it, how for the administration, which included Secretary of State John Foster Dulles, quote, "the desire to escape the stigma that American officials believed came from an association with the Jewish state led them to distance the United States from Israel and to establish the United States as a mediator between Arab nationalism and Zionism." In short, Eisenhower and his top advisors, especially Dulles, saw Israel as a liability, end quote. It was the American foreign policy establishment's belief that Nasser could become an ally of the U.S., and Eisenhower would later learn what a mistake he had made. As Doran further writes about Nasser, quote, "instead he gravitated toward the Soviet Union and worked assiduously to undermine the Western position in the Middle East," end quote. As such, the story of Washington, Cairo, Jerusalem, London, and Paris, the story of 1956, provides us not only with a moment in history, but a lesson and a lens with which to look at the engagement of the United States with Israel and its neighbors. It was in July of 1956 that Gamal Abdel Nasser announced that he was nationalizing the Suez Canal, cutting Britain and France out of any control. This, for British Prime Minister Anthony Eden, was intolerable. Doran again, quote, "In Eden's view, Nasser had established a dangerous precedent of defying Britain with impunity. If he were not seen to pay a price for such behavior, then British basing rights in Jordan and Iraq would evaporate. Soon thereafter, other actors would move to plunder British oil interests in the Persian Gulf," end quote. While a relationship between Israel and France had been established, with France supplying Israel with much-needed military equipment and arms, the relations between Jerusalem and London were still very cold. Doran tells us the plan that ultimately evolved. Quote, "The distrust was reciprocal, and the gulf of suspicion that separated London from Jerusalem posed a major challenge to French Prime Minister Guy Mollet and his foreign minister Christian Pinault, both of whom were very sympathetic to Zionism. How, they asked, could they broker an alliance between Ben-Gurion and Eden? They answered their question with a scheme, stranger than fiction, which they previewed to Eden. Suppose, they said, the Israelis were to attack Egypt first. In that case, the British would be free to intervene militarily, together with the French, in order to protect shipping through the Suez Canal. Paris and London would issue an ultimatum, demanding that the belligerents withdraw to a position of 10 miles on either side of the canal or face severe consequences. The Israelis, by prior arrangement, would comply. Nasser, however, would inevitably reject the ultimatum because it would leave Israeli forces inside Egypt while simultaneously compelling Egyptian forces to withdraw from their own sovereign territory. An Anglo-French force would then intervene to punish Egypt for non-compliance. It would then take over the canal and in the process topple Nasser. End quote. Ben-Gurion, as we discussed yesterday, had been facing the terrible threat of Egypt and of the Egypt-encouraged and supported Fedayeen. Ben-Gurion met with British and French leaders at a secret conference in France, and while enormously wary of the proposal originally, he ultimately embraced the idea. Fascinatingly, he also insisted, as Durand tells us, that the foreign policy plan should be put in writing with three copies made. When Eden found out, he was furious and had the British copy destroyed, but the French had no interest in doing likewise, and as Durand tells us, quote, "As for the Israelis, they were already in the air flying home. Indeed, Ben-Gurion was flying high. On the plane, his spirit soared. He amused himself on the trip by consulting ancient historical sources, searching for the Hebrew place names for the points in Sinai that he planned to annex to Israel. The signed agreement, all the while, remained in his breast pocket, snug to his chest." End quote. This is a fascinating scene. Ben-Gurion looking at the Sinai, not only through the lens of strategy or national security, but also Jewish history. And as Durand further writes, Ben-Gurion found the connection in Jewish history to the Straits of Tiran. Quote, "Scouring historical sources, Ben-Gurion discovered evidence that in ancient times, Tiran fell under a Jewish dominion, which in the Hebrew of the day was named Yotvat. On November 6, he sent a message to the troops of Sinai saying that Yotvat, known as Tiran, which until 1400 years ago was an independent Jewish state, would again become part of the Third Commonwealth of Israel." End quote. Ben-Gurion, in other words, was already preparing for at least part of the Sinai to be part of the Jewish state, not only a buffer between Israel and Egypt. Again, with the hindsight of history, there is a striking irony here because many years later, Menachem Begin would also look to Jewish history in pondering the future of the Sinai. As Avi Shilon tells us in his biography of Begin, Menachem Begin had sought to make sure that the Sinai was not part of the Promised Land biblically before negotiating with Egypt over it. In one fascinating moment, a member of his party, Shmuel Katz, argued against giving up the Sinai, to which Begin replied, "But Sinai is not part of the land of Israel, even according to the Bible." To this, according to Shilon, Katz replied, "What does this have to do with the Bible? I mean, you can use it to prove almost any borders you want." Now this, of course, ladies and gentlemen, is not true. One cannot use the Bible to prove any borders one wishes. Be that as it may, the two stories provide a striking contrast, reminding us as well that Ben-Gurion could never have imagined that one day his rival, Menachem Begin, would be pondering as prime minister the connection between Jewish history and the Sinai. But aside from the issues of history, Ben-Gurion clearly was unprepared for the pressure that Eisenhower would ultimately place on Israel. And as we will see in a later episode, Ben-Gurion would himself face a key choice in American-Israeli relations when it came to how to respond to Eisenhower's response to this operation. But, of course, as the operation unfolded, the first choice was faced by Eisenhower after his allies, Britain and France, had acted. Eisenhower's choice, as Durand puts it, was, quote, "Should he support his allies or Nasser? He chose Nasser," end quote. Reading Durand's book and his description of the quote-unquote Frankenstein's monster that an administration led by a man with such staggering achievements as Eisenhower had produced, I was reminded, given the subject and substance of our podcast, of an earlier moment in the history of the Middle East. Herbert Samuel had eloquently and courageously defended Zionism within the British cabinet and was a key figure in the story of the Balfour Declaration. His arrival in the Holy Land as the first British High Commissioner of Mandate Palestine was therefore seen by Zionists as a profoundly hopeful moment. But one of the first significant decisions by Samuel in the Holy Land was to elevate Haj Amin al-Husseini, who had fomented horrific violence against Jews, to the position of Mufti, helping this man to become not only a terribly influential enemy of the Jews in the Holy Land, but also an enemy of Britain and an ally of the Nazis. It is a reminder that in foreign policy, one must make decisions about individuals based on who they actually are, not based on what one might wish a person to be. Here, as we will see, Eisenhower believed that, in Durand's words, quote, "If the United States would publicly demonstrate firm opposition to the Europeans and the Israelis, it would receive a strategic payoff in the form of widespread Arab goodwill." But the payoff never came. Instead, Eisenhower handed Nasser yet another political victory, the greatest of his career. He helped transform the Egyptian leader into a pan-Arab hero of epic proportions, end quote. We will discuss tomorrow what happened after the initial Israeli operation. For now, we note with Duran how the story is obviously not only one episode, but also a paradigm, giving us lessons from a moment that, as Duran tells us, Eisenhower would understand was a mistake, a paradigm from which we can learn a great deal as we study in future episodes how at very important times American-Israeli relations flourished in the future. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow, signing off.